Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome
to The Roy Green Show podcast.
This was one of the most probably important air battles since World War II. It was just extraordinary. The alliances, the air forces that worked together, that had probably been training clandestinely for a number of weeks, maybe months. What was at stake? We could have been in World War III today.
Canada's former ambassador to Israel, Vivian Berkovich, on this program last week, when we spoke to the former ambassador about the Iranian attack on Israel. And she was very worried the night of. And she did think, she told us that, didn't think she was going to be waking up to World War III the next day, but she wasn't discounting the possibility. It is a worrisome, very worrisome development. And the question now is, did Israel attack Iran on Thursday in retaliation for Iran's missile and drone strike against Israel? Israel's not saying, and Iran claims that drones launched within its borders were shot down. So they're setting aside a requirement for the shooting by the two principal regional opponents to continue. Perhaps the head of the Iranian government, which is very happy to murder its own citizens and has done so repeatedly, said if Israel attacked Iran, it would be mere seconds before Iran returned fire. Israel's ambassador to Canada is back on the air with us. We're very privileged to have the opportunity to speak with Ambassador Ido Moed quite frequently on this program. Ambassador, thank you for coming on. How are you?
Thank you, Roy. Always a pleasure to be with you online.
What is the situation that exists now, today, between Israel and Iran? How do you define that?
So it's a very interesting, when you were talking just now, I was thinking, it's not just two adversaries. There is one party that has declared very clearly it wants to destroy the other, and the other one that is defending itself. It's an aggressor against one that is defending itself, that has a recognized right to exist and to live and to prosper in a safe and stable neighborhood. And there is another one that has developed the most lethal weapon to destroy the other. And so the situation is very tense because the Iranians that up until now have been hiding behind their proxies have now actually come to the front and attacked Israel directly with hundreds of drones and cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, and has continued to vow to destroy and wipe the state of Israel off the face of the earth. So this situation is extremely tense right now. Their proxies have participated in this attack. Hezbollah continues to fire and shoot at Israel as we speak. There are all kinds of projectiles. Just this week, they've managed to hit a location, an Arab village, where Israeli soldiers were stationed at that moment and wound a great number of them, significant number. So they are continuing to try and create a more dangerous situation in the north. We want to prevent any escalation, but Iran's proxies continue to do whatever Iran requires them to. And Iran itself is also continue its very dangerous posture against Israel in any way and any shape and any form. And this is why we are calling now the international community to designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terror organization. This is the arm that Iran uses both for this missile attack and also for their connection with terrorist organizations, their coordination with Hezbollah, with Hamas, and all the others. And also calling for sanctions against Iran because their missile industry, their drone industry, they're all having a lot of exchange with other parts of the world to acquire components that they cannot produce themselves.
Ambassador, Israel isn't saying specifically that it was involved in attacking Iran on Thursday, unless that's changed in the last hours. But it's impossible not to deduce that that was a response. What happened inside Iran was a response from Israel, measured, and more than a warning shot. What can you say to us about that?
Iran is a country that has a very aggressive posture. Iran uses its proxies and shoots directly. So I think the language that they understand is a language that is different than most of us. It's not diplomacy, it's not politics, but something else. I cannot refer to anything that happened last week, but I can tell you that Iran is vulnerable, and they know it. They understand it. And I hope that the message that they're getting from the region, from the international community as well, the joint coalition that confronted them on the day that they attacked Israel, I hope that the message that they're getting is to step down and to stop this kind of aggressive behavior and their attempt to destroy the state of Israel, because it will not materialize. It will not work. I think that's the most important message that they've been learning this week.
Okay. Ambassador Moed, the rest of the world is engaged. Whether they're directly engaged with Israel, whether they're expressing their points of view from the sidelines, whether they're sitting on the fence like this country likes to do. But the rest of the world is engaged and concerned. How much concern does there have to be about the potential, because the outcome of such a development is unknown, the potential for a region-wide war recurring? Ambassador?
Yes, I can hear now. Broke off for a second. Well, the threat that emanates from Iran is far beyond the Middle East. Their missile program has the capacity to reach all of Western Europe. And one should wonder, why would Iran develop such a program if they want only to destroy Israel? What is their actual end game? And why are they acquiring means to threaten regions far beyond? And the answer is very clear. Iran is a threat not only to Israel, but to the Middle East and the whole region, and perhaps far beyond that. Arab countries understand it very clearly, and this is why we found alongside with us fighting against Iran some of our regional partners. But Iran is a very dangerous player on the global scene, and we have to remember that their planning and their plans and their intentions go far beyond just Israel.
Okay, so my question that I've been sort of mulling over the last number of days, once Iran became directly involved, and not just using their proxies, but by firing hundreds of missiles and drone strikes at Israel, how much did that change the equation? And I hate the cliche, stuff the genie back in the bottle, because it wasn't much of a bottle to begin with. But has this just made the situation far more tense, far more volatile, and far more concerning?
In many ways, it has, because as you very rightly point out, Iran trying to face Israel directly creates a situation where things can escalate very quickly. We have no interest in a regional war and a broad-scale war. It has. We are trying to do whatever we can. Also, when we are fighting Hamas, when we are confronting Hezbollah in the north, we're trying to, as much as possible, contain our reactions. But it's a very dangerous development because, as I said earlier, we're in a neighborhood where force is using the use of force is part of the language that is required in order for us to maintain our existence. Israel is a small country. It cannot afford to lose a war. we have to make sure that our opponents, that our adversaries, that our enemies understand that it is not worth their while to attack us. So that means that there is a need to use force every now and then. And so the situation is very dangerous. This is, again, a call for the international community to message to Iran in any way, shape, or form that they're playing a very dangerous game that is not tolerated by the international community. So be it condemnation by the G7 or the United Nations Security Council or any other international forum, but specifically also targeting the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and adding them to the sanctions list so that their leaders will be held responsible for what they are doing right now and the dangerous escalation that they have caused very recently. So perhaps, as you said, the situation can stabilize again. I agree with you, Gene, in the buckle, it's long out, but perhaps we can create a new situation that it does not further escalate.
It's a plan to build housing, including for renters, on a scale not seen in generations. We're talking about almost 3.9 million homes by 2031.
Whoa. That will be a record. 3.9 million homes between now and 2031, says Prime Minister Trudeau. That's what's going to be built. Just think about it. That whole argument just falls apart in the first nanoseconds that you think about it. Dave in Calgary texted us at 877-399-9898. Good afternoon, Roy. I've been thinking about this home building situation and have another concern beyond the obvious. Over the past years, multiple lumber mills have been shuttered in the West, and we've seen huge increases in lumber prices over the past few years. Without the lumber mills to add materials to market, where will the lumber come from and what will it cost? It's brilliant questions. Mr. Trudeau? No, he's not here. I wanted to ask him. And I received an email from, I'm not going to tell you who it is. You'd know his name immediately. But I haven't cleared with him that I can read this on the air. Well, I can, that I can read it. But I haven't cleared that I can identify him. So I'll just read it. He writes, neither the labor nor the supply chains to build these homes exist. That's more than twice as many. I just got an email from him. Okay, let me just read it, and then I'll tell you later if I can identify him. Neither the labor nor the supply chains to build these homes exist. That's more than twice as many homes a year as we've been building. The liberals picked a number and worked backward from there. So somebody in the caucus said, you know what, 4 million sounds really nice. 4 million homes in 7 years. That really sounds outstanding. Why don't we talk to Shane Wenzel? Mr. Wenzel is president and CEO of Shane Homes in Calgary. He's been on the air with us previously. And he shared with us then, during the really difficult, more difficult than even now, economic times with interest rates and inflation, that home buyers who'd purchased or placed down payments on new homes with him were so financially stressed, they were walking away from their under-construction homes and willing to forfeit their deposits. And I was so impressed. Mr. Wenzel told us that he was refunding these stressed buyers their deposits, which raises another question. If Mr. Trudeau, by some sort of, I don't know, you know, let's feed the multiples with two fishes. If he is managing to build 4 million homes, where's the money going to come from the buyers to buy them? When people are in a situation that we already know exists, that 52% of Canadians are within $200 of not being able to pay their bills at the end of the month. Shane, thank you for coming back on the program. President, CEO of Shane Holmes in Calgary. How are you?
I'm good, Roy. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. So I shouldn't be so cynical without asking first for the view of a professional home builder who's very good at it, what your sense is, or Mr. Trudeau's promise, are 4 million new homes by 2031.
That's an impossibility. Plain and simple, it's an impossibility. Just listening earlier on, you had an email come in where they asked, how are we possibly going to do this without the labor in the supply chain? And it's a very true statement. You're asking something of an industry that means we would have to increase what we're doing 150% in 7 years, which, again, you know, I mean, I don't think you need to be a home builder to understand that's laughable.
Yeah. I can actually tell everybody who sent me the email previously, the previous one I read, which is neither the labor nor the supply chains to build these homes exist. That's more than twice as many homes a year as we're building now. The Liberals picked a number and worked backwards from there. It was our previous guest, Dr. Christian Lieprecht from Queen's University and Royal Military College. And then Christian added this in his second email to me. Here's the problem. We're not coordinating. Ontario currently turns down 50% of applicants to become electricians because colleges don't have enough capacity to train them. So it would be really helpful if the feds and the provinces coordinated rather than try to out-politic themselves on this file, and that's what's happening. That's an issue, isn't it, Shane, having the tradespeople necessary?
Well, that's a huge issue that's facing us. We've known for a number of years that we would be facing a number of retirements, Royal. And I think the last stat that I had seen is that the retirements in the trades will be roughly 20% over the next decade. But you don't have enough young people, nor do you have enough people coming in through immigration to cover that. Even build force, you know, which I found was an interesting stat because I've been asked, you know, can you attach a figure to it? So I can only use theirs, but they say 500,000 more on-site construction workers are required now, immediately to reach this target. That would be an 83% increase in that labor force.
So by this target, you mean the 4 million that Mr. Trudeau is talking about?
Yes.
And there's no way on God's green pasture that we're going to get 500,000 new tradespeople now.
No.
Like now.
Again, right now, that is an impossibility.
How long does it take for you to build a home, a functional home for a family of 3, 4, or 5? Not necessarily something that's, you know, over the top luxurious, just a good functional home. How long would it take?
It's kind of a two-part answer. I mean, from the time they purchase to the time we're able to release a work order to the field, it would be anywhere from 90 to 120 days. And then once that home is out in the field, it would take upwards of, 6 to 8 months to complete.
So you can't do one a minute.
No, we can't do one a minute. I would love to. That would make my life a heck of a lot easier. But no, that doesn't happen that way.
So, you know, I've often said you can't outthink those who aren't thinking. So
it's very hard to.
It is
very hard to.
It is. But somebody should have been thinking in that caucus before they went out, before the finance minister and Mr. Trudeau went out and started blathering about 4 million new homes in 7 years. I mean, that you must have got a belly laugh out of that.
There were a few chuckles around the office when that announcement came out.
So at its best, as you understand the industry, at its best in this country, with everybody, every home builder in Canada, every tradesperson in Canada, everyone who can get involved, engaged, and provide support and work toward building homes, if every one of them got involved and worked 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, how many homes do you think could be built in 7 years?
My best guess at it would be about 1.6 to 1.7 million homes total.
That's not even half of what Mr. Trudeau is promising.
No, not even half.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense, please, of how people are doing these days? The last time you and I talked, you were very generous toward people who had delivered down payments to you and couldn't make the payments because their economic circumstances had changed so dramatically. What are you encountering now?
Well, fortunately, with the interest rate stabilizing, I mean, that has worked its way out. But, of course, that's what was leading up to people walking away, is that the interest rates were climbing faster than we could possibly build the homes. Although I will say this, I would say about 15 to 20% of them are far more stressed out by the time they get to the end securing their mortgage, because a lot more people are adding second and third names to those mortgages in order to make it work.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Mm-hmm. And are you encountering that phenomenon that's been written about and talked about of multiple families or multiple strangers, if you will, actually contractually agreeing to purchase a residence, and then somewhere down the road, they'll make a decision who the ultimate buyer is going to be, but to get it off the ground, they're going to combine their resources. Have you run into that?
Oh, that's much more common now.
Really?
Yeah. I would say at least 20 to 25% of our purchasers, there's two names on the contract.
What is the greatest challenge to be a home builder in Canada now? Understanding the need, and the need is massive. All we have to look at is these 10 cities, these 10 communities that have grown up. What is the greatest challenge that you face?
Well, I think the greatest challenge is, for the last 3 years, each and every builder, contractor, renovator has been flat out doing their jobs more than 5 days a week. I would say you're looking at, on average, 6 days a week, just trying to build what we've managed to sell. So it's put a strain on not only labor, it's put a strain on the supply chain in Canada. And to boot, we're dealing with code changes that are honestly not making homes more affordable. They're making them more expensive.
You know, the thing that really troubles me about all of this, about Mr. Trudeau's announcement, and he keeps making it, he's made it over and over the last number of days, 4 million homes in the next 7 years. He's raising false hopes for people. Unless he's got some sort of miracle planned, then people need a home. People, we talked 2 weeks ago with a former small business owner in British Columbia, in Kelowna, who was living in his car because his business life collapsed. He was living in his car, and he seems to be getting ready to move back into his car. And people are looking for, desperately looking for a solution to their challenges and their issues and their home need. And I think it's highly irresponsible of a politician to make promises that you very clearly point out, and Dr. Luprecht points out, they just can't be met.
I would agree with that statement 100%. Ken, if we had talked about the possibility of increasing the our output by 10-15%, and you worked with industry to try and make that happen, that would be a possibility. That would be a possibility that I think we could rely on, and we could put our reputations behind. But again, to increase your output 150% is, again, I go back to the word, impossible.
Shane, if you were advising the Prime Minister and this government on what they should and could do to just reasonably maximize the homes that can be built, the kinds of homes, multiple family units, whatever we're talking about here, what advice would you give them to create this kind of home building, at least appreciable success that we all want to see?
Well, I guess I'd say a number of things. One would be lead, follow, and And quite honestly, get the hell out of the way. And that would be for every level of government. Just let us do what we have to do to get this done in the most appropriate manner. But, I would fall back on the new National Building Code, which quite honestly is making the cost of home building even more expensive to the tune of about $30,000 a home. But at the same time, I would probably say you've got to curb immigration for a while, get the levels back down to what we would consider normal, in order for us to play some sort of catch up in this country. Because with it at its level, the current level, you're just seeing nothing but housing prices rise and rise quickly. Yeah, because unfortunately, all the money they're throwing at it. That's all that's going to do is contribute to prices and rent and our debt going up substantially. I mean, I like the fact that they have, better infrastructure funding for the municipalities, but they've attached strings to it as well, where they want to end inclusionary zoning. Stop it. Quite honestly, stop it. Just give the funding to the city so they can cover off that and they can grow faster. But yeah, those are three or four things that I think that need to happen and happen right away.
Dr. David Poon joins us, public health official, family physician in Saskatchewan, and I've known Dr. Poon for some time now. Been a guest on this program on other issues, and we had a little something to do with getting he and his wife united in this country when it was difficult during the pandemic. How are you, David?
Oh, I'm so grateful. Thanks for letting me be here. And thank you always. Your show was the first we did back during the pandemic when I was able to get my own partner and a whole bunch of other people safely in Canada with good public health plans. And I'll always be so grateful to you and your team for giving us that space to help a lot of Canadians.
Entirely our pleasure. So, David, the budget comes down, and the doctors now in this country are going to be forced by government bureaucrats and bureaucracy into turning in more money to the government because of extensions of the bureaucracy that you as entrepreneurs and caregivers don't need. And it's going to affect the retirement options for doctors, and I think it's going to cost us doctors. So talk to us about the capital gains issue in that budget and what the greatest concern is you have and fellow physicians have.
Oh, well, thanks so much for taking the time. So in short, for your listeners, how doctors get paid in Canada is essentially we do fee for service. We see a patient and we get a lump sum of money. And because of that, we don't actually earn like a pension. We don't have a retirement plan in place from the government because we're essentially private contractors. So that means we're paying for dentists out of our own pocket. We don't have health benefits. We don't have maternity leave. We don't have sick days. So the reason why that's important is how most doctors structure their income is they take those dollars that we get from seeing patients and we put it in a medical professional corporation. So we'll call it a professional corporation. Now, on April 16th, Deputy Prime Minister Freeland announced that corporations, didn't specify which corporations, all corporations were going to have a change in the tax structure that might be a little bit difficult to just talk about through the radio, but essentially it will increase the tax burden on all corporations. Now, when I initially heard that, I thought, okay, well, clearly they're talking about the big corporation. People have been upset over grocery prices and everything getting expensive during the pandemic. But the next day, the Minister of Small Business was on Power and Politics, and she was asked two questions, very good questions. First, aren't you worried that this is going to cause problems with doctors staying in the system? And she responds, hey, we got international medical graduates coming in. And so what? Is the implication, number one, that doctors here already are disposable? And two, that international medical graduates should take less money? So that was a very strange response, but that was the first time doctor was actually associated with this tax change by the government. And then the second question that came in when the journalist David Cochrane was trying to press a little bit more for an answer, the Minister of Small Business says that this tax is going to affect the ultra wealthy. And that is blatantly offensive to doctors who have huge student loans, who are still paying off their mortgage, who have no retirement, have no pension. And at a minister's salary, they actually make more than us, have benefits, pension, airlines, all those things covered. And yet for her to have the audacity to call us ultra wealthy after we served during the pandemic, served the patients, worked 12-hour shifts, don't see our families, is completely offensive. And that is the issue we have today, which is why this week, my partner and I have started Professional Corporation Advocates, because we need an organized response to show the government that this inappropriate issue of calling us the ultra-wealthy, including accountants, dentists, lawyers, and other professionally incorporated individuals, is affecting productivity in Canada. We are not the large corporations they want to go after. And so we're asking them to not include us in this change in the tax structure. If they want to go after the ultra wealthy, it's not us. Yeah. And this is going to just hurt productivity and hurt regular Canadians in the process.
Well, it will. I mean, the budget changes, capital gains tax, is going to be rising to 2/3 from 1/2 of a portion of a capital gain as of the 25th of June. And then when you sell your investments, liquidate your investments in time of retirement, there's going to be an additional and substantive tax, and that's going to hurt. Ontario Premier Ford has predicted this new capital gains tax could force doctors out of practice and could hurt patients. So are you hopeful that are you hopeful that the government is going to listen to you ultra-wealthy physicians?
Well, I don't know, ultra-wealthy physicians, because you know what, Roy? I haven't met a physician with a monocle yet or a top hat. But I'll let you know if I do find one.
All right. Yeah. So, I'll give you mine.
Professional corporation advocates will be doing an organized letter-writing campaign.
Okay.
I just booked some time to speak at, have a parliamentary press conference. We'll have a number of different efforts to show our elected officials that their constituency is having major issues with both the tax structure being applied to hardworking Canadians, as well as the villainous characterization that someone who is driving a 15-year-old Toyota Corolla is an ultra-wealthy person.
David, let's pick up on this again next weekend as you've gone a little bit further, and we'll find out what you're hearing from your fellow physicians. Good to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you, Roy.
Take care.
Carboneau now bringing the puck. Carboneau's pass to Bernabéu's goal. Carboneau pass went in front of the net, and now it is 3-0. And the crowd at the Forum in Montreal watching this game tonight are delirious.
Guy Carboneau carrying the puck over the blue line, and a couple of seconds later, my good friend Kelly Rudy was reaching behind him and saying, "Oh no, not again." Kelly's been on the show quite a few times, as you know. So, as has Guy Carboneau, the former captain of the Montreal Canadiens, really appreciate. Guy, thank you so much for coming back on. How are you?
I'm doing good.
It's good to have you back on the program. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I know I asked Kelly Rudy, I told him, I said, I'm going to have Guy Carboneau on the program on Saturday. Want me to say hello? That was a tough time.
That's okay. He was actually pretty good in that series. So
yeah,
but I was happy. I was happy that I was able to pass, put one behind him.
Yeah, well, that was quite the call on the play, and watching the fans in the Forum, because you were playing in LA for that for that particular game, right? Hey, you know what people remember most? I think not only the fact that you won the Stanley Cup and the last Canadian team to do so, but there were those 10 overtime victories.
Yep.
The Montreal Canadiens, how does that happen? How does one hockey team win 10 straight overtime games in a Stanley Cup series or a Stanley Cup?
I don't know. I mean, and actually, we lost the first one.
Oh, so I forgot that.
And then we won 10 in a row. Like, I mean, you know, 10 hasn't been done before, but, you know, you go on a run. Patrick was playing extremely well. He had a lot of confidence in himself and the people that he had in front of him. And, you know, it was just, but you get to six or seven and then, you know, You know, I've been to Vegas before, and the odds you think the odds are going to guess against you at one point. But yeah. I was happy that we made it to 10. It was quite a run.
Well, it was amazing, and I just listened back to some of the audio of the play-by-play earlier today, and this is really exciting because I told you on the phone the other day I've been a Habs fan since I was a kid, so mm-hmm. it's really I'm so glad it was it's Montreal Canadiens I could talk about. And not the Toronto Maple Leafs, even though I'm in Leafs territory right now, so they'll be waiting for me at the front door when I leave.
Well, we went we're pretty close to play them in the finals that year.
That's right, yeah. What wins a Stanley Cup for a team? What would you say is most important to either do well, move ahead through the various series? You know, some people say, well, you got to have the goaltending. Some people say you got to have defense. Some people say you got to have the scoring. Other people say you got to have all three. That's a very tough thing to put together.
Yeah.
What's the most fundamentally important thing for a team to have?
Well, you know, obviously you got to stay healthy. I think that's huge. If you're, you know, especially, you know, I think every team pretty much in the NHL now has, you know, they do have five or six or seven extremely good players. If you're able to kind of go through all the playoffs and keep those guys healthy, then you know that every night you're going to have a chance to win. Goaltending is one of the ones that's really important. Maybe not as much today, but you know, I think you know goalies needs to be solid throughout the game. Try not to give bad goals, just so the team doesn't get too much backup and stop attacking. You can always say, you know, you need defense, you need guys to score goals, but I think once you need all of that really to kind of be successful. There's not, you know, I don't remember the last 30, 40 years that I've watched playoff hockey. Every time, every year that, you know, the team that comes out as a winner, there's always a bunch of things that happen during that every series that makes it that, you know, whatever it's goaltending, scoring at the right time, power play was hot, penalty killing was really good, or they play well defensively. So,
yeah.
A bunch of things.
Yeah. There's only one player who has a C on his jersey. And you were the captain of the Montreal Canadiens, which is an incredible tradition.
Yep.
To be the captain of the Montreal Canadiens. What's the special responsibility that goes along with being number 21 and the captain of the Montreal Canadiens in 1993?
Well, you know, I got drafted in 79. I was the dream of mine when I was a kid. You know, every Saturday, the only game that we had on TV was the Montreal Canadiens. So obviously I grew up, you know, watching a little bit of Jean Béliveau, and later it was Guy Lafleur and Bob Gainey and you know, all those good players. And you know, because of the team in those years won a lot of Stanley Cups, and then you end up with the team. You know, I was lucky enough when I started, before I became captain, you know, all those guys like Jean Béliveau and Maurice Richard and Henri Richard and Yvan Cournoyer, and you know, we had Serge Girard. Everybody was always around the room for the games. We had dinner, you know, if we had an event, like they were always around there. So, you know, you learn, you hear their stories, you know how proud they were from, you know, to do everything that they've done. And you know how hard you have to work to achieve that. So, you know, I took it seriously. You know, it's a great honor. And then, you know, you just try to do your best.
Yeah. Well, you did. And you wore the C with great dignity. I've always said to people, I've called you a few times for an interview, and you've always been extremely gracious and said yes, even when if I was just being a pain in the backside, asking for you to come on the air with me. So then you leave as a player, you got involved in coaching, you actually became the coach of the Montreal Canadiens. What special responsibility does that bring? I mean, I grew up in Montreal, and I know what it's like. At any time the Canadiens breathe, the rest of the province exhales, because we want to know what's going on. What's it like to be the coach of the Habs?
Well, I was an assistant coach first. The years I retired in 2000, then 2001, I was working for the Canadians. And then, they decided that in November to change coach and Michel Therrien took over. And then they asked me if I wanted to be an assistant coach. So I went behind the bench and that was a lot of fun. I loved the experience. Working for an organization like the Montreal Canadiens was pretty, a lot of fun. But, I just retired a year before and, you spend a lot of time in the office and, you feel like you're not accomplishing a lot of things in the office. So at least, behind the bench, I felt at ease. It was a little, you get involved a little more and, so I learned, part of the job there. And then when I had the chance, when Bob Gainey called and said that he wanted me to take over, I was a little bit more ready, but you're never ready because I was not a career coach. I was a player. So I had to kind of learn on the fast, a little bit like Martin Saint-Louis did when he started. Got a lot of knowledge. He was an ex-player, so he understands the game, but coaching is a different thing. When you play, all you have to take care of is yourself. when you're a coach, you have 23 guys, and they all want to make a lot of money. And they all want to play 25 minutes. And they need to know everything that, why or what happened and how come I didn't play that period or how come I didn't play on the power play. And so it's sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes you just, you learn from them. I always said this, I was only a coach for 3 years, but I was a lot better at the end than I was at the beginning. So, you learn on it. But yeah. Being in Montreal, there's, the media is always there, but I was used to that. So it wasn't something that I didn't understand. So it was just, but I'd love to get up in the morning and then go to the rink and then look at the video and trying to find, ways to beat the opponent. So that's what I love.
So we're going to have coaches in Vancouver, coaches in Edmonton, Winnipeg, and Toronto.
Yes.
In the playoffs that start tonight. The first Canadian team that's going to play, the only one tonight, is the Leafs.
Yeah.
How do you assess? I want to ask you to assess the coaches. That wouldn't be fair. But how do you assess the teams and their leaders? I guess I'm bringing the coaches into it anyway. How do you assess this team, the four teams, and their leaders and their chances at actually replicating what you did with the Montreal Canadiens in '93?
Well, I think I look at Winnipeg and the goaltending has been strong. I think Vancouver finally, same thing. I think Toronto has been battling that throughout the year, but I think they need to their goalie to make the save at the right time. All four teams can score goals. I think whoever is going to be able to kind of play the best defensively has got more chance. And then, I think Toronto, I have them beat Toronto this year. But, at one point, the best player is going to have to kind of not show up because I'm not saying they're invisible. But, when they get pushed, they're going to have to push back. Because in the playoffs, space is a prime, but you have to make your own space sometimes. And I think in the past, they got pushed and they didn't push back. And, teams that play against them realize that pretty quickly. And then when you get up, wake up, it's too late. So, I think it's going to be a little different. I think they added some grit. Those guys are going to have to kind of do their job and then play better defensively. If they want to advance.
Well, we're all hoping that it'll be a Canadian team that wins the Stanley Cup this year. We have some really good teams that are in there.
That would be fun. I know we were the last one in '93. That's 30
years.
1 year.
31 years. So, yeah.
It's been a while.
So, and you'd be getting less calls from guys like me.
I don't know. I get, that's okay. I don't mind them. So.
Okay, well, Guy, thank you so much. Congratulations on the Stanley Cup, being the captain of the Montreal Canadiens, being the coach of the Montreal Canadiens, and being in the Hockey Hall of Fame. You've given us
Thanks, Roy. You've given us a
tremendous number of thrills over the years. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.